Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 30th of March. It's All Things Political, always at Monday on 9, and we have a special emphasis the first half hour of our program on violence in Mexico and trying to contain an increasingly deadly drug war. We'll talk about arms that have been coming from the United States and a huge demand for drugs in the United States that fuels this violence in some ways, and what the governments, the Mexican government and the United States government, are doing to try and deal with all of the violence. The second half hour, more of a domestic focus with the Obama administration asking the chair and CEO of General Motors, Rick Wagner, to step down. He said yes. What about the chairs of other banks? Why haven't they been asked to step down? A lot on the president's agenda today, a meeting this Thursday of the leaders of the group of 20 industrialized and developing nations. We'll be talking about the world economic crisis and ask our first guest about that as well. We'll look at a new policy that was unveiled on Afghanistan and Pakistan, the NATO summit, which will try to ask for more world support for both of those missions, and the president also going to Turkey on Sunday. And then I would imagine the news will focus on the dog. Don't you think so? The dog ought to be there by next week. We have two guests with us. The first half hour of our program, Jose Diaz Briseño is with us. Since 2005, has been the Washington correspondent for Reforma, the leading daily newspaper in Mexico City. His reporting covers U.S.-Mexico affairs from border security and immigration to trade and tourism. He was based in Tucson, Arizona, before that, working for U.S.-Mexico border affairs correspondent for Imparcial, a regional daily in northwestern Mexico. And he has also worked as a researcher for the Los Angeles Times, and we're happy to have him with us. He studied international relations in Mexico and has also done courses on U.S. history, so he's the perfect guy for the first half hour. Later, Alexander Lamas will join us, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Mr. Diaz-Briseño, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Can you explain to me where the violence related to the drug trade is most prevalent right now and how many deaths? I was astounded to hear how many deaths there have been in the past few months. Is it confined to certain regions of the country, and how bad is the violence?
Exactly. Well, Kathleen, from the numbers we get at our newspaper, Reforma, which is the largest news daily in Mexico, we have counted that these year we have had 1,493 executions, related to drug trafficking, and 693 of them were located or were occurred in, you know, the states in the border with the U.S., specifically Chihuahua, that borders New Mexico and Texas, Baja California, that obviously borders California, and Chihuahua, Baja California, and and Coahuila, another border state with Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it is almost one third of the deaths, and they are occurring in the border states of Mexico. But we have had gruesome cases of violence also in the inland.
And is a lot of this violence recent, or have these cartels been operating for some period of time?
No, this wave of violence has been there for the past 3 years, at least.
There's a big story, I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, in today's New York Times, that looks at the cartels and talks about how they bring in billions and billions of dollars, and as a result, they can easily pay off politicians, judges, prison guards, and police officers.
Exactly. This has been a historical problem of Mexico. I think corruption is an issue. We have to remember that Mexico in general is a young democracy. Up until the year 2000, one-party rule was prevalent in Mexico with the PRI, and many of the institutions that, we consider working normally in a democracy like the courts or the police have been absent for decades, you know. So it is not until the very last years of the 1990s that, in general, democracy starts to flourish, you know, freedom of expression, training police. So we're lagging behind in many of those areas. But, you know, I think there's been an effort done.
So the Mexican government has an effort going on to clean the country of that kind of corruption?
Yes, you know, I think it's very difficult to assess because obviously we don't know, there are no details of or numbers of how big corruption is. But yes, there are efforts. You know, it was with very pain that the government recognized this past September that the Mexican drug czar was actually involved in drug trafficking or at least protecting some of the cartels in Mexico. But I think this goes beyond, you know, corruption of public officials. I think what Mexican society is realizing is that even, let's call it, small corruption is hurting in general the, you know, the rule of law in Mexico. And this is not only a government's problem, but a society's problem.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about where all these drugs are going. Where's the demand for the drugs? In the U.S. mostly?
Yes. Mostly Mexico is a transit country for, you know, drugs to the United States, all types of them, methamphetamines, marijuana, cocaine, and obviously also heroin. And Mexico is growing as a market, but still more than 80% of the demand for the drugs that transit through Mexico is in the United States. And I think this is what's missing in the whole equation and and something that the Obama administration has increasingly admitted. And, you know, most recently, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, was in Mexico and recognized this fact that, you know, the demand of drugs was basically the driver of this violence.
Sure.
And for Mexican ears, this is just a huge change in attitude.
And the guns that are used for these acts of violence, these many acts of violence, are also coming from the United States?
Correct. There's no specific statistics, but both American and U.S. American Mexican officials recognize that at least 90% of the weapons that are used in drug crimes in Mexico come from the U.S. And yes, there is now a documentation to confirm that there is a pipeline of weapons going south.
Mr. Diaz-Paseño, how do they get into the country?
That's a great question. You know, because this is a two-way street. On one hand, the Mexican government has complained, and I think correctly, that there are basically no investigations in the U.S. Of this illegal export of arms into Mexico. But also, you know, Mexican controls at the border are very lax. Whoever has traveled to the border states, you know, if you go south to Mexico, there's basically just very few inspections. So, you know, the argument of the Mexican government is that it doesn't have the enough resources to check all the cargo and vehicles going south. So that's why they are asking for U.S. help in doing some southbound inspections.
Mm-hmm. Our Homeland Security Secretary, as you well know, announced plans to boost the personnel and surveillance equipment. Are you thinking that's a good idea? And what are we talking about in terms of what needs to be boosted here?
Yes, there was a sour sweet taste to the Secretary Napolitano's announcement. Why? Because first, basically, if you read the detail of the fact sheet that was distributed by the White House of the efforts that we'll be undergoing, most of them are a boost to programs already existing during the Bush administration. Basically, for example, the Project Gun Runner, that is carried out by the ATF, you know, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives Agency, will increase its personnel. But, you know, the Project Gun Running was already working during George Bush. And, you know, 100 guards from the Border Patrol will be doing inspections in the southbound lanes. And, you know, people in Mexico saw this as a good sign. But still, if you read the whole fact sheet, the very last point in a three-page communique was dealing with demand of drugs. And I think that's the thing that still is missing from the equation.
How do you deal with that issue? What do you do about demand? How do you lessen it?
That's great. You know, that's a great question because there are many. I think there are many answers depending who you ask. But obviously, there's a growing debate in the U.S. by groups that want to end the prohibition of drugs, saying that you know legalizing many of the drugs could reduce at least the violence in Mexico, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether that would have any effect on the demand. General Barry McCaffrey, who, you know, was the former drug czar during the Clinton administration, said that basically any legalization of marijuana would increase demand, at least in the short term. You know, it was just striking to see this whole strategy developed by Secretary Napolitano only having as a very last point in demand reduction. And basically, she was highlighting $68 million dedicated to the system of drug courts that, from my understanding, has been successful in reducing, reincidence of first-time users. But I think you need more resources than $68 million to drug courts, to treat demand in different ways, prevention and information and education.
Mm-hmm. In those cities where there has been a lot of violence, is there also a desire to leave the country? And have people tried to?
Let's see. Most of the cities that have been impacted by the drug violence, specifically homicides and executions, are located in the U.S.-Mexico border. And one of them, let's say, it's Ciudad Juarez, that I don't know if you've seen, but it's been in the news in different network channels. There are 10,000 army personnel stationed now in Ciudad Juarez. The police has been disbanded, and even the mayor of that city, Ciudad Juarez, just very next to El Paso, Texas, is living currently in the U.S. because of different threats to his integrity. So he's basically governing from abroad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whether there's a desire, many people that, have been extortion or suffer direct consequences of the drug war, like, say, let's say, reporters who write about drug violence or some police chiefs would certainly like to leave the country. But still, I think even in those border areas, there's a vibrant middle class that has no other chance than staying in the city, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in just one moment. Our guest this first half hour is the Washington correspondent for Reforma, the leading daily newspaper in Mexico City. Jose Diaz Briseño is with us. We're talking about what's going on with the increasingly violent drug war in Mexico and what's happening with drugs coming to the United States, the demand for drugs, and how to lessen violence. What kind of policy is going to work? It's been very much in the news the past few months as the violence has become worse. We'll also ask him to comment on the G20 summit, which is taking place later this week, and look a little at Mexico's economy, too, and how they're doing. Are they part of this global crisis? Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to send one, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about what the recommendations are for cancer screening. As you know, there were two studies released a couple of weeks ago that looked at whether or not screening for prostate cancer is effective. There have been different kinds of recommendations for breast cancer screening. What about forms of cancer for which there is no screening now? Will there be some in the not too distant future? We'll have two guests with us, a cancer surgeon and a breast cancer specialist, both from Froedtert and Medical College of Wisconsin. So that's coming up next hour. To your phone calls now. Our lines are jammed for Mr. Jose Diaz-Briseño, and we start with Joe from Wausau. Joe from Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen. Ah, goodness, I've been trying to talk about this for quite a while now. We saw violence like this when alcohol was illegal, and I really think continuing this drug war is becoming less and less feasible. We're entering a budget problem where we're going line by line and removing things that are expensive, and the drug war is extremely expensive, and the only reason there is violence is because we've driven it underground. If we legalize it, we can put hefty taxes. We were just talking about the raise in cigarette taxes. We can tax these drugs, and we can regulate the industry. The only reason these people resort to guns is because when it's an illegal substance, you can't use the court system to figure out your disputes. So if the business is legitimized, the gangs will lose their source of funding, and violence will disappear. You don't see people having Valentine's Day massacres over alcohol anymore, and that's simply because it's legalized. I think this insanity of this drug war has got to stop. People are being victimized, our jails are filling up, and it is causing a huge budget problem, and many people are suffering. We have got to stop prosecuting people for choosing what to put in their own bodies.
All right, Mr. Diaz-Briseño.
Yes, I do respect the listener's opinion, and, you know, I understand very well the arguments of legalization as a way to reduce violence in Mexico. And I think it's valid. I think it's worth exploring some decriminalization of at least some of the drugs. But I am not sure whether that's the end of the problem for Mexico. I think the problem with violence and, in general, narco-trafficking is that it's corrupting other areas of the, you know, of the state. And I think the less sexy response of how to end to, you know, how to end violence in Mexico and in general criminality is a profound judicial and police reform in Mexico. I think that even if you know drugs are legalized, criminal groups will act in other trades, in other types of you know goods. If and it's not until you know the Mexican government puts more effort in its judicial reform that by the way started in 2008, that we'll see, you know, a lesser degree of violence and, you know, more prevalent state rule of the law.
Thanks, Joe, very much for your call. Isn't it astounding? I read these numbers about how much money is involved in all of this, and it's just flabbergasting, isn't it? Billions and billions of dollars.
Correct. The estimates are that between $11 and $25 billion are sent every year from U.S. consumers to you know, Mexican drug syndicates. So this has prompted the Mexican government to, you know, send very nationalistic calls to say, hey, you know, if your consumers are sending so much money down because directly to the drug syndicates, why are you not providing us with more, you know, anti-drug, you know, assistance?
Mm-hmm. Dave is our next caller. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning. Mr. Diaz-Briseño, a respectful question to you, sir. Being a very responsible gun owner, I do take respectful issue with the information that's being floated around now. As you had said, sir, that there's no empirical data to back the fact that the guns, at what level they're coming in from the United States. How do we arrive at the 90% number, and how do we know that other guns aren't coming in from third world countries below Mexico? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yes, I think that, you know, the 90% number comes from traces from a sample that the Mexican government has developed in many cases. That's how they arrive to the conclusion. They basically take the numbers from the guns and basically run them in the E-Trace database that the U.S. government provides. And basically, they found matches in at least 90% of the cases.
Let me switch subjects for a moment because we only have you for a couple minutes before we go back to phone calls. What are your hopes for a lot of international gatherings, important ones taking place? What are your hopes for the G20 in London later this week? From the perspective of being a journalist, a top-notch journalist in Mexico, what's Mexico hoping for?
Well, in general, Mexico is trying at least the U.S. Trying to see, what is going to be the U.S. Leading role in this crisis. They are still trying to figure out the different rescue plans that the government in the U.S. has proposed. And, you know, Mexico has been hit a little bit and it's not until these past months because of the economic crisis in the U.S. As you know, 80% of our trade occurs between the U.S. and Mexico. Most of our oil exports go to the United States. Tourism is one of the largest industries in Mexico, and it is depending on U.S. consumers. So first, I think as a country, Mexico wants to see the U.S. taking a leading role in, you know, orchestrating some type of general solution. But also, I think, I don't know if you know, but Mexico was currently invited by the U.K., and specifically the president, to do a state visit to London. And I think Mexico also has some hopes that the visibility of being among the G20 countries could erase the image as a lawless country, close to Somalia rather than the developed world.
Mm-hmm. It's sometimes hard to understand how enormous this problem is, isn't it? It's affecting every country on the planet.
Correct, and I think if you go down to Latin America, it's not only Mexico that's suffering this wave of violence, but Guatemala, that has even less resources, is going through a terrible crime wave derived from drug trafficking. Mm-hmm. But if you go down, you continue with El Salvador, obviously Colombia, Venezuela, many, many areas, at least in the Western Hemisphere, are very affected.
Yeah. Let's go to Jane from Appleton. Hi, Jane.
Hi. My question is, first of all, what percentage of marijuana do you feel is coming from Mexico? And do you think that if we legalize marijuana in the United States, allow states to tax it, and also the feds to tax it, and use that taxation money to actually combat the incoming of arms from the United States and to combat the truly illicit drugs that do kill and make a mess of our society coming up from Mexico. Do you think that this would help in your cause to eliminate the violence that's going on there?
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. You know, this is a very interesting question because we seldomly hear about this, but the U.S. is growingly more and more a self-sufficient country in terms of marijuana production. You know, close to 50% of the marijuana that is consumed in the U.S. is basically grown domestically. I don't have the exact number. It's very hard to find all these different reports. But it's estimated that close to 50% of the marijuana is produced locally. At least the other one-third comes from Mexico. And obviously, people who are against prohibition would stress that marijuana is the lesser evil of all drugs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do you have time for just one more phone call? I hate to – we got you all the way from Mexico. Can you take one more phone call?
No, anytime. You have
okay.
Open to
okay, great. Ken from Milton is next. Hi, Ken.
Hi. The violence has increased because, let's talk about the situation of Juarez right across from El Paso. The police department are the smugglers, and the only good guy was the mayor. And how he survived is a real mystery to me, because he had to call in the Army to fight the police department. I mean, he had to call in a battalion of airborne city street fighters to take on the Juarez Police Department, you know, the 203 or 300 policemen that are smuggling mm-hmm. in the guns and smuggling out the drugs. And then that's where you get your violence. I mean, when you get the airborne and the police fighting, then you have violence, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's just one, I don't know how big Juarez is now, but it was a village 40 years ago. Well, it's probably a city now.
Mr. Diaz Briceño, can you comment?
Yes, but of course, since President Calderon started in office back in December 2006, basically he sent more than 40,000 troops of the Mexican army have been sent to troubled areas in the country. It's, you know, the Mexican version of the surge. And yes, at least 10,000 of them are in Juarez, which is a specific violent area in Mexico. But yes, I, even with the surge and so on, I just don't want to leave an impression to our listeners that Mexico is a place that you cannot visit. I think that's even when the violence is terrible and gruesome in some cases. First, it's seldomly against tourists. If you go to State Department figures, it's more probable to be dead in Mexico because of bus and highways rather than, drug violence. And, there are 18 million people visiting Mexico from the U.S. every year. There are 36 million crossings in the U.S.-Mexico border every year, for local purposes like business and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were you, I would say, yes, Mexico is confronting a very difficult situation. I would not recommend going to Juarez, obviously, but I would not hesitate in telling you, Mexico is a safe place to be. I would never cancel my trips.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us. Please join us again. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Kathleen.
Thank you, Mr. Jose Diaz Briceño. He's been the Washington correspondent for Reforma since 2005. It's the leading daily newspaper in Mexico City. He also was based in Tucson, Arizona before this job, where he worked as the U.S.-Mexico border affairs correspondent for El Imparcial, a regional daily in northwestern Mexico. He has also worked as a researcher for the New York Times. All things political continuing. The Obama administration asking the chair and CEO of General Motors to step down. He said yes. Today, the president outlining the next steps to help GM and Chrysler. But the public has grown a little weary of bailing out just about anybody. And so one wonders what the next plan will be when we've already given the auto industry a lot of money. We got the NATO summit coming up. We got the G20 summit coming up this Thursday. The president's going to Turkey to give a speech as the first visit as president to a majority Muslim country. But probably this most important world economic gathering in decades, if some have described it, is where we will concentrate some attention during the course of the next half hour. This our guest this half hour is joins us fairly regularly, Professor Alexander Lamas. He's an associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University, and we thank you again so much for joining us. Hi.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you? Happy Monday.
Yes.
Yeah. It's going to be a week. It's already started off here with a wallop. The administration asking the chair and CEO of GM to step down, and he said yes. I guess the question after that is, why didn't he ask a lot of other people to step down from some of these financial giants?
Well, I think people will be making that comparison, especially when they get the full details of the auto plan. We'll find out here in less than a half hour, I guess. Exactly what the details are. But it looks like it's a pretty tough plan. I've heard that Chrysler is being told it has to cut a deal with Fiat and, you know, within 30 days, and GM has to come up with a major restructuring within 60 days.
Hmm.
And then, of course, the top man forced out.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right about the financial institutions. You know, people are really angry all through the country because, you know, the average person didn't do anything to deserve this this uncertainty in the financial area, and it's affecting everything economic.
It sure is. I guess you wonder how much the public can take here, and you tell me how much you think that we can take. We've already bailed out GM and Chrysler. They've received $17.4 billion, and now they want another $16.6 billion for GM and another $5 billion for Chrysler. It's a situation that can't keep going on.
That's right. But the president has made it clear that, you know, the auto industry is something the United States can't lose, and
mm-hmm.
so he doesn't want to see the industry collapse. And it's not just the big automakers; it's all the suppliers, and, you know, there's so many jobs involved. And so I'm sympathetic with what the administration is trying to do, but they will face public opposition. But the numbers, you know, for the auto industry are large, but they're small when you compare them to what we put into the financial institutions.
Right. And when do you think we're going to get some idea of where all that money went? I don't think we have a good idea of that yet.
No, we don't. And I listened to Secretary Geithner on the Sunday talk shows yesterday, and they're not firm numbers about even how much money is left in the funds. But we'll know at some point. I mean, but it may be, you know, it may be when the scholars get into the records years from now.
Mm-hmm.
But the political impact, I think, is, you know, is something we'll definitely sense a lot sooner. President Obama, as you know, and your listeners know, is engaged in activities across so many fronts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's stunning, really, when you step back from it, and you know, just the domestic arena is full, and these big deficits are there, the debt is increasing, and so forth. And then you have all the foreign policy questions as well. It's a lively time for national politics.
And it's only been, what, something like 66 days, 67 days? It is astounding.
That's right. But out of that comes, you know, the opportunity for a great presidency. And, you know, it's often been said that even people who have the potential of being great presidents don't make it because they serve in very tame times without these great challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an opportunity for, you know, great achievement. But there's also the other side of it, failure. And we don't know how this is going to come out.
That's the thing, isn't it, that we don't know how it's going to come out. Are you hopeful?
Oh, sure. And I would say that's probably the feeling, you know, across the country, across partisan lines as well. I mean, everyone wants the country to do well. Politically, I'm sure, you know, the Republican Party obviously wants to come back. And so they, you know, they may hope for the country to do well, but the president politically to stumble. But, you know, you go back to, you know, to another time, something like this, when FDR took office and March 1933, we had no idea how that would all work out.
Mm-hmm.
And politically, it worked out extremely well for FDR and the Democratic Party. People are still debating the impact FDR's policies had on ending the Depression. But there's no question that he rallied a new majority in the country. And I think that's the potential right now with the Obama administration and the hope that they have is to solidify a new majority for the Democratic Party coming out of this.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what has been described, and I'm wondering if you would agree with this description, the most important world economic gathering in decades in in London, and you couple that with thousands of people in the street, the anti-globalization protesters, also just people who want to see Obama because he is an international celebrity right now. What can we hope to have happen in just a day's meeting? And can you assess the strength of European opposition to America's plans to rescue the economy?
Well, apparently, some European governments have a different approach. They're not interested in these huge deficit expenditures to spur their economies, and they have a perfect right to take that route because no one knows exactly what's the correct medicine. But I would think that there's a lot of goodwill for President Obama among those European leaders and leaders of the other advanced economic countries. But I think related to this is the whole Afghan policy initiative that was announced, and I don't know how you've been handling that on your program, but it's certainly not popular in some elements of mm-hmm. Some segments of the Democratic Party. It looks like to that contingent that this is going to get us into another quagmire, and I think that's a potential thorn in Obama's side.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry about that?
Oh, absolutely, uh-huh. Absolutely. I mean, and it's an extremely difficult situation that we're thrust into. No one wants to see terrorists have a safe haven again, but on the other hand, Afghanistan has been subjected to foreign involvement for many decades, and that usually doesn't come out well for the foreigners. I mean, people like to have their country's destiny determined by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that means unsavory elements are in power, but we can't control that everywhere. But on the other hand, we can't give the terrorists a safe haven either. But apparently, it's the Pakistan part of the equation that's the most dangerous. I mean, that's where we think the Al Qaeda headquarters are, and Pakistan policy is dicey.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for you. It is amazing how much there is to talk about each week. So take your pick. If you want to talk about GM and Chrysler, if you want to talk about the G20 meeting or the new policy on Afghanistan and Pakistan, the NATO summit trying to get support for expanded U.S. operations in Afghanistan that Professor Lamas was talking about, we certainly welcome your calls. 800-486-8655. Alexander is an associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. Our email, you could do that if you want to. That's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after the news from National Public Radio at 10, cancer screening and the controversy, most recent controversy about prostate screening. We'll also look at all other kinds of screening and talk about what the recommendations are and welcome your phone calls. So that's coming up the second hour. To your phone calls now for all things political, and some lines are open. They rarely are, so take your chance. 800-486-8655 is the number. Maddie from Waupaca is our first caller this half hour. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I just hope that the American people remember that this downturn in the economy happened during a Republican administration, and don't blame President Obama for it. And that's my comment.
Okay. Professor Lamas?
Well, that's certainly a good point. And the records show that the recession started some 18 months ago. But it doesn't take very long before people look at the current administration and want to know why it isn't solving our economic problems. So he despite the reality that to call a very accurately expressed, President Obama will get a lot of responsibility here.
Mm-hmm. He sure will. It becomes his problem after a while, right? If these policies don't change things, then it's his problem.
Absolutely, and it's already, as you can see, the debate between the two parties over what is the proper way to get out of this recession. The Republicans have been very cohesive in saying these deficits are wrong, that the spending in the areas of health care and other initiatives are not the way to go, and so forth. And if you know if there, the downturn continues and it appears that these policies aren't successful, I'm sure that will be the core of the Republican campaign in the midterm elections.
Do you think that he's going to be able to get this massive budget passed? There would be changes, but when he talks about this definite need for significant health care reform, cap and trade, education policies, that those are most crucial to him, will those be included in the budget, or is this going to be one rip-roaring fight?
He won't get everything. I think the health care initiative is the most likely to sail through.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone realizes that is a severe problem. But we'll see. The Democrats do have healthy majorities in both houses, not a veto or not a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, but they're close. I think you're going to have a big battle over this labor issue, card check,
mm-hmm.
and that is very important to all players. And just a few days ago, Senator Specter of Pennsylvania is on the is one of the swing people in the configuration in the Senate voting. He said he's opposed to it, and of course he's had labor support all of his career, and I'm sure they're very disappointed with that because the labor unions very much want it, and the businessmen very much oppose it.
Let's go to Weston from Mineral Point next. Hi, Weston.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a comment and one question on the loans with GM and Chrysler. You mentioned earlier you called them bailouts, and the difference between the bailouts of the financial institutions and the loans that were given to GM and Chrysler is that the loans have to be paid back. It's not just free money that the government's giving them. But I did have a question about why is GM and Chrysler so afraid of going bankrupt? Why don't they claim the bankruptcy so that they can restructure all their agreements and start over?
What they've said is they fear that no one will buy their cars once they go into bankruptcy, fearing that the warranties will be worthless. But I understand as part of the policy President Obama is going to announce that the government is going to offer assurance about the warranties on new cars and those recently purchased. So we'll have to see if that works, because bankruptcy may be where GM is headed. And restructuring that would then occur a little bit more easily through the bankruptcy courts than otherwise.
Thanks, Weston, for your call. Let's go to Ed from Darsville, Iowa. Hi, Ed.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to make a comment. A previous caller said that this is not Obama's fault, which is true. But how Obama handles this is going to be critical. It could be handled either by more spending or by bail out failing companies or by cutting spending and cutting back government, which I think the way it should be, and many experts are pointing to that too.
That we should do more cut back on government spending in on the military and domestic programs? Where?
Well, in general, as a concept, not to have bigger government and more spending. I mean, we're already deeply in debt.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do now is stop spending, cut back government, and not bail out failing companies. Failing companies failed on their own, mm-hmm. and taxpayers should not be taking the brunt of bad management. If the companies fail, other healthy companies will come and take their place. I mean, it's not all gloom and doom.
Mm-hmm.
What I think that the spending will do and all these bailouts will do is extend the agony.
Mm.
This will push this into the future. We have twice as much debt or whatever number it is. And now we have a bigger problem. And now we're printing money. We're printing $1.2 trillion, which is going to take down the dollar. And if the dollar is rejected as an international currency, we got a much bigger problem.
Mm-hmm. Professor Lamas.
Well, I think, you know, tied in there are really two issues. Is what do you do about the financial institutions and the automakers? And then there's the question of heavy government spending to spur the economy through infrastructure projects and all those things. And the current, you know, economic orthodoxy is that in downturns, the government has to make up for that loss of demand with big spending. And this is, you know, this is when we look back at other recessions, we see that there's a lot of evidence for that. We got out of the Depression, you know, finally because of this huge deficit spending that occurred during World War II. I mean, we went into enormous debt. Of course, everyone agreed that was necessary to meet the war emergency. And I think the argument is that we need to have that kind of mentality now with this downturn to prevent it slipping into a worse recession.
Thanks, Ed, for the call. We go to William from Viola. Hi, William.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Earmarks, it seems the only thing that the Republicans and Democrats agree on. I mean, it's, you know, 40-60 Republican earmarks and 60% Democrat earmarks. And I personally believe that this is what's corrupting our Congress and our legislative system and really destroys our, you know, vote of the individuals because we aren't really adequately represented because the lobbyists are really controlling what Congress does and doesn't do. And I would like to see better investigative reporting on these earmarks and who gets them and how they get them and how they get added to the bills and why they're not debated. I think there should be, you know, more transparency, more openness, and I'd like to see an end to the earmarks, period.
Professor?
Well, it appears that that's the direction that, you know, that we're moving. The president did sign this bill that was, in a sense, leftover business, but he said no earmarks going forward and transparency in this whole matter, that so people can't put forward earmarks without being identified with them and so forth. And so I think that's one issue that is well on its way to at least containment. But the other question, and the broader question the caller raises, is a vital one, and that is the influence of well-supported big money interests, mm-hmm, on government in Washington. And the key to that, of course, is the campaign finance reform. One reason that these lobbyists have so much influence is they raise a lot of money for the politicians, and we haven't seen that come on dead center yet in the Obama administration. Even though President Obama has, you know, said a lot about it.
Yeah, he said a lot about it, and as many other administrations have done, he took a lot of money from AIG. Right? It just doesn't end with no matter who's there.
Well, that's. The case up to now, but we don't know, you know, the future. You know, we have to be optimistic in the sense that we have solved a lot of these big problems. If you go back, you know, over American history, you could just take a quick one from two centuries ago, civil service reform. You know, people, we had a spoil system before civil service reform, and also the post office, you know, was patronage ridden and so forth, and we ended that. So I think we can come to grips with this question, and we need to, because I think your caller is exactly right. People are very suspicious of how people with a lot of money get their way in Washington, mm-hmm, and it'll be interesting to see how that, you know, how President Obama, who has a position on this, a very strong reform position. We'll deal with it.
Right.
Obviously, hadn't put it on the, you know, the front burner.
Oh, there are so many burners, and they're all going, right? They're all boiling.
That's
are
right.
They ever boiling? And what about our confidence in him? Do you see it wavering at all? He's had phenomenal support from the public.
That's right. He's extremely popular personally. His family is too. The First Lady is popular. I mean, people are just delighted, I think, across the board with him and the kind of actions he's taking, even though there, you know, obviously we have disagreements on the policies, it hasn't touched his personal popularity. And it will be interesting to see, you know, see how that plays out.
Right. And I keep thinking, wait till the dog comes. Then we change focus. Then we can learn about dog training and see puppies frolic on the White House lawn. And it'll be good, don't you think?
Yes.
Well, it's going to be quite a week. You wonder how any president can do this, don't you? They just must not sleep very much. There's just an enormous amount. It's hard just as a journalist to keep up with what's going on financially and what's going on with Afghanistan and Turkey and Mexico. There is so much going on. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely. It's going to be exciting to read the accounts, you know, some time from now when we get the full inside story because so much is going on. But the president has assembled, you know, a very talented team and he's showing a lot of managerial skill. You don't see it, you know, out front, but it has to be there for this policy coordination to work as well as it has in these 60-some-odd days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether the policies are correct or not, they've certainly been put in place in a skillful fashion.
Yeah. William, thanks for your call. Professor Lamas, thank you so much again for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah, we'll talk again. Professor Alexander Lamas, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, our guest for this half hour of the program. And we also thank Jose Diaz-Briseño, the Washington correspondent for Reforma, the leading daily newspaper in Mexico City. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Rob Schroeder on-air production. We return following the news.